We are progressing through American history here at a snail's pace, but we are moving along rather well, and I hope you're learning something through all this. Sometimes history can be a little boring, but last week we looked at, basically we focused on the French Revolution. You say, what in the world are you doing teaching history in a church? It's amazing how history lines up with the Bible, and how biblical principles will promote or demote a country and its ideology when they side with the Bible. And we looked at the French Revolution last week. The French Revolution took place basically right on the heels of the American Revolution. And when you consider both of those revolts, as the name may be, you'll see the two distinctions between a successful revolution and a failure. The French Revolution is a flop. It is a failure. And the French Revolution ends with the Reign of Terror, with the guillotine, people losing their head, normal innocent people being slaughtered in the marketplace, people being brought into question simply because they did not greet you with the right greeting. You could have them hauled into prison and have their head cut off if they were not careful. And the French Revolution ended with people mistrusting people, right on the heels of the American Revolution. And that would cause a thinking person to consider, what in the world was the difference between these two revolutions? What happened? And we pointed out to you that the French Revolution last week was an attempt at liberty without the advantage of the basis of a biblical foundation. And what we had in the United States, regardless of what the revisionist historians will indicate, was we had a Bible base, a base for morality, and our revolt, as well as the country that was set up after that revolt, was based on biblical principles. In Europe, when the French Revolution took place, you have again still there the papal attitude, which has existed from the time of Columbus, and we went through all of that. But suffice it to say, the attitude of the papacy is, if you don't agree with us, we'll imprison you. If you don't agree with us, we'll kill you. The Spanish Inquisition is still alive and active during the French Revolution. Matter of fact, the Spanish Inquisition is not formally called off until the early 1800s. It is still effective. You can still be questioned by the church and put to death by the church at the time the French Revolution takes place. The distinction is this. In the United States, the fight was to keep religion and the state separate entities in order not to allow a particular denomination or church to gain control of our country. That was the ideology. The United States and the establishment of its government was never to prohibit religion. Now, that's what's happened in these last days, is the state has become the antagonist of the church. The state has become the attacker of the church in the last 20 years. The Internal Revenue Service announced last year that for the first time they will begin to selectively audit Americans. And the first group on their list is preachers. This year they have stated that one out of every 50 preachers will be audited by the IRS. Why? Well, that shouldn't cause you to worry if you're not cheating on your income tax. However, you know, is that not discriminatory? Okay, but the state has adapted an antagonism toward religion in its ideology. It began with no Bible in the school, began with no prayer in the school. Say, well, that's a separation, that's a violation of the Constitution. It is not a violation of the Constitution. As a matter of fact, the individuals in the Supreme Court, when they passed the decision, admitted that up to that point, 1962, the Supreme Court had cited on at least, I think, 17 or 18 occasions that that was constitutional to have a Bible in schools. But that the thinking of America had changed to such a point that no longer could it be defended by the Constitution of America. So what transpired was when this country was established, and we'll not go through all that, suffice it to say, it's easily provable that America was established while on an idea that no one religious denomination, no one church would be allowed to control the government. Why would they feel that way? Look at Europe. Europe was under the control of one church. That's where our forefathers came from. Whether it be in England under the Anglican Church or whether it be in the rest of Europe under Roman Catholicism, they knew what it was to have a church controlling the state or in joint control with the state. And that's not what they wanted in America. You look at our revolution here, our revolution was successful. We founded a nation, we have a constitution that has been the supreme document of our land for 200 years. In the same process of time, Europe, in particular France, has gone through over 100 different types of governments. Not just changes in people that ruled, but different types of government. Why? Their revolution was a flop. They still don't have what they wanted. And today France is basically socialistic. It's a menagerie of socialism and monarchism, although there's not a lot of monarchy there, but there's still some monarchical tenets in the government, and dictatorship. It's all right. It's a mess. And what happened in America, we looked at the revolution last week, so we're not going back through that, but what happened in America as a result of it, the American people are fresh from their own revolt. They have seen the success of their revolution against England. They now have seen freedom. They are beginning to put in place the foundations of their own government. And again, this French Revolution began 1787, 1789, so it was right on the heels of the founding of this republic. And the Americans are very pro the French Revolution. And matter of fact, one of the historians stated that the French Revolution was not received anywhere in the world with as great of respect and rejoicing as it was in America. Because the ideology here was, wow, we've done it, now they're doing it. But the difference was they weren't doing it. And as the French Revolution transpired, the Americans began to back away. Because they saw what was going on. And in the end, it was not France opposing a monarchy, but it was Frenchmen killing Frenchmen. And it was citizens dying in the streets because no one group, they didn't have any idea what they wanted. And the guillotine was used extensively. And problems were incurred by America because of the French Revolution. First of all, as the support began to wane in America, and I think I pointed out to you last week, I believe we got that far, where we talked about even some of the streets in America changed, that they had their names changed to support the French Revolution. Americans, of course, the term in France during the time of the Revolution was they stopped calling people madam or sir and started calling them citizen. And certain cities in America, that became the way of life. They met each other with the greeting of citizen to support what was going on in France. Not long after the Revolution began, Lafayette was forced to flee for his life from France. If you know anything about Lafayette, you know he was the contributor of, really, to the American cause of freedom. He was a general that came here and helped train our troops and helped basically overthrow the British rule here. Lafayette was an American hero. Matter of fact, was one of the first American heroes. And Lafayette now has to flee his country in fear of his life. That causes mixed emotions. Americans begin to look at what's going on. They begin to see the reign of terror and the bloodshed and all that is going on there in France, and they withdraw even further. Now, at once, the Federalists and the Republicans are taking sides. And again, the Federalists are opposed to siding with anybody outside the United States. And their whole idea, we might compare them to nationalists, only there's some other tenets we'll have to look at, but at this point, at least, they're nationalists, they're isolationists. We don't need to be involved in somebody else's business. Let's back away, or if we do, let's squash this thing and stop it. On the other hand, the Republicans, under the headship of Jefferson, they're very pro the French Revolution. Jefferson, to the very end, maintained that the mass of the people in France would do the right thing. And he had to admit his futility in that ideology because they never did. But America begins to polarize them. And the two ideals begin to separate the American people. And the question is, what do we do? France now goes to war with England. And there's a war going on over there. And America's kind of caught right in the middle of it. And Washington declares neutrality. The first step that we took was in 1793. We declared neutrality not only in the affairs of the Revolution, but also in the war that was being waged between Great Britain and France. And again, that was an unpopular decision with the Americans to sit back and do nothing when most of them saw a need to do something. Brought Washington and one of the first decisions that he made under the scrutiny of the American people. But he decided and opted for neutrality. and stay that. Now, one thing's funny about neutrality, and that is you can't be actively involved with either country if you're going to stay neutral. And so America's attempt to trade, we were trading with France, we were trading to, on a limited extent with England, very limited, but we were trading with those nations. And that decision for neutrality brought about another relationship with Britain. When we decided for neutrality, Britain then passed legislation that stated that the British would begin to seize quote-unquote neutral ships, which was funny because the United States basically was the only neutral country at that time. But the wording was they would seize neutral ships, and anybody that was trading with France or anybody that was trading with her colonies, their ships now were open game for the British fleet, and they would be seized. Not only that, but American seamen were impressed. That's the word used. They were impressed into British service. So the British began to seize American ships, and not only would they take the cargo, they would also convert the ship to a British ship. It would be carrying a British flag. Not only that, but the sailors that were on board that American ship were forced to, at gunpoint, to enlist in the British Navy. And they became part of the British Navy. The ship became a British ship, and all at once, instead of being a neutral American cargo vessel, it became a British warship under the command of a British commander. And Americans didn't know quite how to handle that. You know, it's one thing to have another country treat you bad, but especially when it's the country you just whipped. And America now is sitting back watching Britain again exercise or flex its muscles. And remember, America never really fought Britain to gain its independence. Okay, you know, we talked about the movement, the hand of God and all that. America never really fought Britain. There is no way the American colonists could have defeated the British. What America defeated was the British soldiers and Navy stationed in the colonies here. Britain never made a full-fledged effort to take America back. If she had, well, I guess if she had, God would have performed another miracle, but the miracle that he performed was keeping the large portion of the British forces out of the conflict. And America, on the side of the colonists, they did defeat some of the crack divisions of the British regiments. It was not a slouch affair at all. Britain had some muscle here, and the colonists did defeat that. But we never went up against the real British Empire, so to speak. And now, when we get out on the open seas, we're no longer dealing here on our home territory. When we get out on the open seas, now we're dealing with the real might of the British naval power. And you're looking at some of those British man-of-wars. I don't know what they had, 40 guns to a side. You take a cannonball about this big, fired into the hull of a wooden ship, and you multiply that times 40, it wouldn't take much to reduce a ship to splinters in just a very few minutes. And the Americans now are beginning to see the full military power of the British, and they've really never withstood that. And now then they've got to make some major decisions as a country, no longer as 13 colonies whose homeland had been invaded, but now as a country whose ships were sailing halfway around the world and being attacked openly by a foe that really they didn't want to mess with. And so the British began attacking and seizing the neutral ships. Not only that, but the forts along the Great Lakes area that, of course, after the war, the British had agreed that all forts and everything were forfeit, that the American government was a nation, they would respect it as a nation, but until this time, the British forts were still occupied. The Great Lakes and the forts around the Great Lakes are still occupied by British troops. They haven't pulled anything out. And so again, you see how intimidating the British has become of the American forces. We declare neutrality, and all at once this thing comes back to the forefront of, hey, we've got 25 or 30 British forts scattered up here along the Great Lakes that still have British regiments in them, ready to fight, ready to go to war. Not only that, but we have British ships now on the high seas that are seizing our American ships. They're stealing our goods. They're plundering our goods. They're kidnapping our sailors. And America is faced with some real decisions. And what happens at that point is a fellow by the name of John Jay. And John Jay, of course, was the first member of the Supreme Court of the United States. He was the first Supreme Court judge in the United States. John Jay is made an ambassador. He goes to Great Britain and he negotiates what's called Jay's Treaty. Now, Jay's Treaty basically was a washout because the Americans got nothing. As a matter of fact, John Jay was burned in effigy, and when I can't remember who it was, the vice president attempted to make a speech in support of Jay's Treaty, he was literally stoned off of the platform. You know, America's come a long way now. We're civilized, but back then, when a politician got up and began to lie, they stoned him. Of course, now the politician goes to the podium stoned most of the time, and so we, you know, rarely know what's going on. But they stoned him off of the podium. Such was the anger that was generated in America because of the Jay Treaty. And the Jay Treaty basically said this. It said, number one, British forces must withdraw from their forts in the American country, which basically was just a rehash of what already had been agreed to. It didn't say they would do it, just said that they had to do it. And secondly, it said that the British agreed to allow the Americans to trade goods in some more British ports, which is not really what we were after anyway. We wanted to trade with France. But it allowed American shipping to gain hold in some more of the British industry there, British ports. And then thirdly, it stated that America then would pay all of the British merchants for all the money they lost in America because of the Revolutionary War. Sounds like a typical congressional move, doesn't it? And basically, Americans were very antagonistic toward that. All they saw was that basically we get nothing and we now have to pay Great Britain. And they saw that basically as being held hostage. And there was anger generated over it. We talked about the stoning, the anger that was there. On the good side, the Jay Treaty kept America out of war. We did not need to go to war with Britain. And I mean, probably a miraculous turn of events. If we'd gone to war with Britain, we probably would have lost. It's one thing, again, to defend your home country. It's another thing to go out on the high seas and fight a battle with the greatest naval power that had existed in the world until that time. And the Jay Treaty kept America out of that war between France and Great Britain. And, you know, to say something good about the treaty, that was true. Secondly, another good thing that came out of the Jay Treaty was the fact that when America's differences with England were finally settled, and again, the Jay Treaty marked more of an end of America's hatred of Great Britain in the eyes of the rest of the world than the end of the Revolutionary War. When the end of the Revolutionary War came, there's the Treaty of Paris that ended the Revolutionary War. We talked about that months ago. But when that occurred, American and British hostilities ceased. The hatred did not cease. And we talked about Britain still continually antagonizing America, antagonizing the industry, not allowing American goods to be traded in Britain. We went through all of that. And now finally, under the Jay Treaty, the rest of the world looked and said, America and Great Britain have made peace. America now is going to be permitted to trade in Britain. America now is going to open up trade negotiations, and they're going to begin to deal with Britain. And the rest of the world saw the Jay Treaty as the end of the antagonism between Britain and America. Because of that, Spain began to look at its relationship with America. Because before, I mentioned, all these other nations were hoping for the downfall of the American Republic. They were just there circling like vultures, waiting for the American Republic to fall apart. And they were praying that it would. They were hoping that it would. They all had vested interests in this country, and in particular, Spain. And now at once, when Great Britain and America have finally settled their differences, at least that's what it appeared, Spain gets a little upset. Spain begins to worry because now Spain fears that not only might she have to fight the American colonies, but she might have to fight the American colonies and their ally, Great Britain. And so Spain immediately launches into negotiations. They say, we want a treaty. And of course, the treaty with Spain was called the Pinckney Treaty. And that treaty was negotiated, and what it did was even more important than the Jay Treaty. But it would not have been possible without the Jay Treaty. That's why I mentioned both of them. Really, there's why in the world would you have to know those names? Well, they're very important because the Jay Treaty produced the Pinckney Treaty, and the Pinckney Treaty was more important even than the Jay Treaty. What it settled was this, the question of the British authority in Florida, the Spanish authority in Florida. How many have ever been down to Pensacola, Florida? I think it's Five Flags. They call it the city of Five Flags. And one of those flags that's flown in Pensacola, Florida, is the Spanish flag. Western Florida was in dispute as to whether it was owned by the colonies or whether it belonged to Spain. And there was a growing sentiment of the inevitable fact that war would occur over that piece of land. And the Pinckney Treaty settled that. It stretched the boundaries and established the boundaries and said, okay, this belongs to the American colonies. Not only that, but it opened up the Mississippi River. What is at the mouth of the Mississippi River? New Orleans. New Orleans was a Spanish city. The Spanish controlled the mouth of the Mississippi. What did that mean? That meant that Americans who were expanding westward from the original 13 colonies did not have access to the Mississippi River. And what the Pinckney Treaty did is it opened the port of New Orleans to what we would basically today call a duty-free station, where Americans could bring their goods down the Mississippi, out through New Orleans, out the mouth of the Mississippi, without incurring any duties or tariffs imposed upon them. And that treaty was more important than the Jay Treaty because as we moved westward, we needed a route or an avenue to bring the commodities, the crops, the goods that were produced out and around to the eastern seaboard. And realize again today we just put things on a semi-truck and pull it across the turnpike. But back then you had to cross the Appalachian Mountains, you had to face the Iroquois Indians, the Cherokee, the Cree, you had to face all types of Indians. We talk about the Wild West, and you know all the shows show the cowboys out west, and there were more Indians killed in this part of the country right here than died from here to the West Coast. You are in the Wild West, and if you read the accounts of Pennsylvania, Ohio, Indiana, in through there, you're going to read more about Indians and atrocities that occurred not only on the side of the Indians, but the white man as well. They occurred right here. And to send products back across those mountain trails, sometimes impassable in wintertime, and to try and get your goods there and then sell them at a competitive price was nigh unto impossible. But to load them onto a ship and let that boat lazily float, you know, and sail down the Mississippi and then out and around to the East Coast without any opposition, opened the markets for the westward expansion and promoted the westward expansion. So the Pinckney Treaty occurred, and as Americans began to expand west, and I'm not going to deal a lot with the Indian question and all of that, and there's much said in the revisionist history of today that Americans, you know, were brutal to the Indian, and we caused most of the problems and all that, and that's simply a neglect of fact, okay? Now, I will grant you that the white man committed as many atrocities as the Indians did. Now, I'll be honest with you, some of these men, Custer deserved what he got. All right? Some of these guys deserved everything they got, but the Indians were guilty of some real atrocities on their own. It was the white man that taught the Indian how to scalp. Okay? But it was a French Catholic that taught him how to do that. Okay, and I say that not to be antagonistic again in the Catholic Church, but I want you to keep realizing the ideology that came from Europe. Okay, and that ideology, if you don't like, if people don't agree with you, kill them. And that's basically the attitude that the French had. They came over here and taught Indians how to be fur traders. Well, if you're going to trade furs, you have to skin them first. And the French taught the Indians how to skin. And that's where scalping came from. But the nations of the Iroquois existed in New York, upstate New York, Pennsylvania. You had in America, or in Ohio, you had the Shawnees. You had Powhatan was in this area. You had all kind of Indian tribes here. And as they got to the Ohio River Valley, they began to stand against the white man. Basically, they had been pretty docile to the white man landing here. We mentioned as we looked at the Pilgrims and their settlement here, the Indians saw the coming of the Pilgrims as the providence of their own God. The pilgrims, when they landed at Plymouth Rock, settled in the one place on the eastern seaboard that the Indians would not have disputed ownership over. When they landed at Plymouth Rock, the Indians said, "That's where nobody wants the land you just settled on. It's yours." If they landed anywhere else, there would have been a war to fight. And the Indians accepted the white man. You got to realize the Indians really saved the white man's skin when he first settled in this country. And to be honest with you, the white man promoted the bounty of the Indians. It was not just the white man that starved to death, but there were oftentimes Indian villages that starved to death. Indians had no medicine. And when the white man came, they basically, for a period of 25 or 30 years, benefited each other. As they began to trade, Indians were taken and got into Europe. And we talked about Squanto, who was educated in England and had an English education, became a great man, a statesman with his own people. But as the white man began to expand, the Indians began to get the sneaking suspicion that they were losing. And they kept getting pushed further and further back. And you say, "Well, you know, we had no right to do that." But listen, you look at it today. What if you want to move out into the country? And you move out into the country. What happens in 10 years? It grows up all around you. Well, what if you don't like that? What's your option? You buy up all the land around you, or you can move further out into the country. You keep retreating. And nobody says anything about it today. I mean, don't you think that's unfair? I bought a home about 8 years ago. We built a home. It was in a country setting. And they built almost 200 homes within 2 miles of my home in the last 4 years. I think we ought to stop them. We ought to put war paint on and go scalp some of those people moving into those new homes. Now listen, that's a revisionist ideology. The revisionist says, "Well, you know, the white man kept expanding, it kept expanding. What do you expect these poor Indians to do?" Well, what do you think society would think if I did that? I mean, you've heard, you can't stop progress. Amen. Somebody said, "Well, these white men came over here and took this country." Can you imagine what shape Europe would have been in if the white men hadn't come over here? It was inevitable that somebody eventually would expand to the unused land. And I tell you something right now about the unused land where you live. That nice little 5-acre empty field down the road from you, it is inevitable eventually somebody's going to build a house out there. And you might as well accept it. If you don't like it, you're going to have to move further off into the country. And inevitably, the country's going to disappear. That's what began to happen in the Indian culture. And, of course, you know, the Indians are a little different mentality. I kind of like the Indian way. I like having your closest neighbor 20 miles down the road. To me, that seems like utopia. I like when you want to eat dinner, you go down to the stream, catch a couple of fish, put them on the stick, and grill them out in front of your teepee, you know, and eat. Go out into the woods, shoot a deer, you've got enough food to last for 3 or 4 months, feed your family. You don't have to go to the grocery store, no taxes. I mean, you know, a good way of life. But the Indians began to see the threat of the white man. And the white man began to introduce some other commodities. Again, I'm not poking fun at nationality. I'm trying not to poke fun at religion. But a lot of the corruption the Indians were given came from the French. The French were the traders. They were trading for the pelts and the furs. And they began to find things that Indians like to trade for. And one of the main commodities was whiskey. And the French began to trade the good old French whiskey and wine for the pelts and the furs. And what they basically did was begin to reduce the dignity of the Indian peoples. And the whiskey, and I mean, it was called firewater by the Indians. They actually had a better term for it than we did. They realized its destructive capabilities, and in essence, they reduced the dignity of the Indian peoples. Now, if you don't believe that, you go up to the Six Nations Reservation right now up in Canada and take a look at it. You're looking at about 70% alcoholism. You say, "Where'd that come from?" That came from the white man. And we're talking about, well, we need to give the Indian back his land. We need to treat, now listen, before we can treat the Indian with dignity, he's going to have to overcome his own problems. Whether they were given to him by the white man or not, he's got a problem with alcohol. He has a problem with alcohol. And the Indians, because, they used to, if they were going to war, they'd put the war paint on, they'd dance around the fire for hours and hours and hours, and now at once they just take a couple of swigs of whiskey and go shoot somebody. And the problem begins to go greater and greater and greater. Even as early as the settlement in western Pennsylvania, the Indians began to make raids into western Pennsylvania. We mentioned the fact that George Washington, who was a great general during the American Revolution, suffered losses twice. I mean, he knew what it was to get whipped. The Indians defeated Washington twice in his early career. And he knew what it was to pick up the remains of families that had been scalped and their homes burned and their husbands and wives butchered and children taken and stolen. That's what took place in Pennsylvania and Ohio. It didn't take place out in Kansas and Missouri. That took place here in Pennsylvania and Ohio. And you've got those Indians as they began to go to war. And I said I ought to say this. One of the most, I guess probably not one of, but the most decisive battle in Indian warfare was fought within 4 miles of this building. And a lot of you never been there. One of the most decisive battles in the warfare between the white man and the Indian was fought right here at Fallen Timbers. And Anthony Wayne defeated the Indians and stopped a lot of the raids. How many of you have never been out to Fallen Timbers? You know, some historians we are, huh? Actually, it's not like there to see, but that's where the battle was fought that basically made the Indians realize the plains, because we're not going to make it right here in the Midwest. And they forsook their hold on the Great Lakes. You can see why they didn't want to leave the Great Lakes region. But as a result of the Battle of Fallen Timbers, they were pushed on off into the plains and on up into Canada and made their living there. Now, the nation was expanding. I said, that's inevitable. And as it expanded, you realize and see the importance of the Mississippi River. Kentucky became a state in 1792. Kentucky, that's an Indian name. Kentucky was the hunting ground of about 9 different nations of Indians. And, of course, when we talk about tribes, several tribes were part of the same nation. You had the 6 nations of the Iroquois. That was even a larger conglomeration of Indians. But they had different ways. They had different laws. They had different ideas. But those tribes made up a nation of Indians. And you had several nations of Indians that shared the state, what is now the state of Kentucky, as a hunting ground. And some of you want to go back to Kentucky. I don't know why, but that's where all the Indians went to hunt. As a matter of fact, there was no war allowed to be fought in Kentucky. The Indian tribes would not war with one another in Kentucky. And they would go there. I think it was Simon Kenton who settled Kenton County, Kentucky, and Cincinnati on up to Dayton. Kenton's wife named Springfield, Ohio. They came as far up as the Miami River Valley up through there and settled all of that territory. This is back before, you know, Daniel Boone and those guys were just beginning to cut their way through the wilderness, and Kenton and those guys were right alongside of them. But Simon Kenton talked about being in Kentucky at one time, and the buffalo came through. If you can imagine buffalo in Kentucky. And the buffalo came through, and Kenton wrote in his diary they had to stay in a tree for 2 days while the buffalo walked past where he was. Such a large herd, he couldn't get out and go in any direction. They completely surrounded where he was. And it took 2 days for these buffalo to migrate past where he was tied up in this tree. They give you an idea of what it was like. He at one time said that he could leave and kill a stag, which was a deer, I'm sure a white-tailed deer, within 10 minutes of leaving his house. He could have a deer brought back. That's how plenteous the game and things were. So the Indians utilized that area. They did not want to leave this area. They wanted to stay put. But the Battle of Fallen Timbers kind of decided that you're not going to make it here. You either stop warring and accept the white man, or you move on west. And they decided to move on west, by and large. Tennessee becomes a state, 1796. So states are being accepted into the Union. And here's the key test of the Constitution. Because under the Constitution of America, those states that were created out of what we call the Northwest Territory were to be admitted to the Union on equal basis with the original 13 colonies. And the real test came now because these states are beginning to come into the Union. And sure enough, they were received as equals. How easy it would have been for the 13 colonies to say, well, hey, you know, we were here, we fought the Revolutionary War, and now you want to be a state and enjoy all the good stuff, but you're going to have to pay higher taxes, you're going to have to do this and this and this, but it wasn't that way. The Constitution protected those states coming into the Union, and they were received as equals as they came in. Now, Washington has been president. He served basically two terms, and it's time for Washington to retire. There's an election about to be held. And I just wanted to read to you an excerpt of Washington's farewell address. This farewell address was in every public school textbook before 1940. It was required reading in order to graduate. You had to study it. From 1940, it was removed, or in 1940, it was removed from every public school textbook, and it does not yet appear in them at this point, unless it is in what we call an edited form. All right. This speech, you'll find it in several college textbooks, in an edited form, okay, or in abridged form. Whenever you read historical documents, you want to read and see whether it says it's abridged or edited. If it is, 90% of the time, what is abridged or what has been edited out is religious content. And if you don't believe that, go get the books and see. That's easily provable, 90% of the time. And what has been abridged or edited out of Washington's farewell address, he makes four warnings to the American Republic. He said there are four things that can destroy America, and all four of them relate to America's relationship with God. And those four things are pulled out of the college versions now that college students read. And I just want to read to you an excerpt from what Washington has to say here. He says, of all the dispositions and habits which lead to political prosperity, religion and morality are indispensable supports. In vain would that man claim the tribute of patriotism who should labor to subvert these great pillars of human happiness, the firmest props of the destinies of men and citizens. What are they? Religion and morality. George Washington, the father of our nation, said that any man who labored against those two thoughts was not worthy to call himself a patriot. That's quite sobering. Today you're called the religious right. And the nation stands back and says, "Woo, we've got to be careful of the religious right." Why? Because they're religious and moralites. They want to impose morality on America. Washington said if you subverted those two things, you were not a patriot. To be honest with you, I'd rather be part of the religious right and be on Washington's side. George Washington, the father of our nation. He says this, let it simply be asked, where is the security for property, for reputation, for life, if the sense of religious obligation deserts the oaths which are the instruments of investigation in courts of justice? You know what Washington said? He said religion is the basis in the courts in America. Anyone see how far we've come in America? That case in Pennsylvania about a year ago where the fellow was found guilty of first-degree murder, there was not even any question about it. And during the sentencing, as the prosecuting attorney made his statements, he quoted a verse of Scripture, and the entire case was overturned by the Supreme Court. And the man got off free. A convicted murderer can get off free because an attorney quoted a verse of Scripture in the courtroom. And they say, well, you know, we believe in the separation of church and state. Washington didn't. Not in the sense you're talking about. I'll tell you what Washington believed. Washington believed that the Baptists should never control Washington. Washington believed that the Catholics should never control Washington. Washington believed that the Presbyterians should never control Washington. Washington believed that no religious denomination had any right to control the government of America. That's what Washington believed. But Washington never for a moment believed that religion and morality didn't have a place in government. And let us with caution indulge the supposition that morality can be maintained without religion. Boy, there goes education. Washington said, you can't teach morality without religion. Whatever may be conceded to the influence of refined education on the minds of peculiar structure, reason, and experience, both forbid us to expect that national morality can prevail in exclusion of religious principles. That's George Washington. We could read more, we won't, just to give you an idea. You ought to read those speeches, if you can find them unabridged. You see why those things have to be taken out of textbooks? How can you have high school students and college students, when you're teaching from an atheistic point of view, or an evolutionist point of view that there is no God, how can you allow statements like that to be attributed to the founding fathers of our nation? So you change it. That's called revisionist history, and it is basically a way of life in America now. So the election comes up. Washington is ready to retire, and the argument or the battle for the presidency of the United States, Adams and Pinckney, the fellow that negotiated the Pinckney Treaty, is going to go against Jefferson and Aaron Burr. And, you know, the caucuses occur, and the millions and millions of dollars in political funds, you know, transpire. Did you know, I think it was, I can't remember who it was. I'll have to get to you later. Up until about 20 years ago, I can't remember who the president was at that point, but I know there was a vice president in the United States who had to pay for his own staff. You've got a vice president, I'm just talking about not to indict the vice president, but you've got a vice president now that has a staff so large you could run one of the major corporations in Toledo on the money that he takes out of the tax budget to control. Matter of fact, his wife has a press secretary and this, that. She has enough staff members to fund a small business here in Toledo, a successful business, paid for at taxpayer expense. That wasn't so until about 20 years ago. Up until that time, you went to Washington. As a matter of fact, the vice president used to have to pay rent on his own apartment. There was no vice presidential mansion. I guess Quayle was responsible for building that. And it didn't happen. But things have changed. Anyway, the battle takes place. I would imagine that the entire cost for both campaigns, any member of this church could have paid easily. Without any problem. And Adams is elected, and the strange thing occurs because the setup of our Constitution called for the electors to cast votes. I'll bet nobody here understands the Electoral College. I'll bet I don't understand it fully. I'll bet it was still one of the strangest things ever put into the Constitution of America. But they immediately began to realize that after they decided to hold an election. Because in the Electoral College, what was stated is that when your vote was cast, you did not really elect the president or the vice president. You elected the electors. And the electors then got two votes, and they could go and cast their two votes for the president of the United States, the vice president, whatever it was. And the first problem they had, of course, remember, Washington has two terms under his belt as president. No problems. He just got reelected. But now we're going to elect somebody else. Washington's not running. And so Aaron Burr and Pinckney go at it from one point. They were the Federalist candidates, the Republican candidates, Jefferson and Burr. And the electors are elected. The electors go to Washington to cast their votes. And guess what happens? I'll tell you what happens. Adams is elected president. But Thomas Jefferson is elected vice president. And now, for the first time in American history, you have two men from opposing political parties, president and vice president of the United States. You see, there was no stipulation as to how you had to cast your electoral votes, just that you were elected to cast the vote. And most of those men that went to Washington that were elected were pro-Adams. They wanted to see Adams get elected, but they didn't really like Pinckney. And so when it came to voting for vice president, they voted for Jefferson. And so Jefferson is elected vice president of the nation under John Adams, which was a real treat because they opposed each other ideologically on almost every point. And Jefferson becomes vice president. And as America begins to emerge now, it begins to take on what we'll call an anti-foreign policy. There is so much antagonism between Jefferson and Adams that America really is on trial for its life. realize again, Adams is the strong Federalist candidate. The Federalists believe what? They believe in a strong, centralized federal government. They believe the federal government was to control it all. They believe that the president, the Congress, should make all the rules for the American Republic. That's basically the ideology of America today. They're the big government candidates. The Republicans, on the other hand, are the small government. They're called the anti-federalists. And the anti-federalists were opposed. They believed in this, God help us, this is a God-forsaken term, they believed in states' rights. They believed the job of the federal government was to maintain trade and foreign policy, and in the event of war, raise an army. That was it. They believed that the states then could conduct the rest of the business and the affairs, and the statement in the Constitution said that any powers not regulated to the federal government were reserved to the states and to the people respectively. That's what the anti-federalists believed. And now you've got one of each in the White House. And problems become immediately obvious, and America basically is drawn to an anti-foreign policy because of the Federalist influence. America begins, or the White House begins, by introducing several acts, and I'll give them to you. First of all, these beginning around 1798, the Naturalization Act. One of the first moves of the new president was to bring in what's called the Naturalization Act. And the Naturalization Act extended from 5 years to 14 years, the length of residency necessary before you could become a citizen of the United States. Why? Because all these foreigners were coming, and the Federalists' fear was that they would become citizens and vote against the Federalists. And so the time limit was expanded. No longer could you live here for 5 years and then ask to be a citizen. Was expanded to 14 years of residency before you were qualified. The second move was called the Alien Act. The Alien Act granted the president the right to deport or to banish individuals who were deemed to be treasonable or secretly involved, had secret inclinations, is what the treaty said, the act said, which is real vague. If the President of the United States deemed your actions treasonable or secretive, he could have you banished. If you were here living in America, remember you had to live from 5 now to 14 years. Anywhere during that 14 years, the President could send you out of the country. Not only that, but then came the Alien Enemies Act. The Alien Enemies Act stated that at the time or during the time of war, the President was free to banish any aliens for any reason at all. He could send them out of the country. You say, what is all this about? This is all about fear that the Federalists had. You see, people were coming to America for freedom. And the Federalists were afraid of the majority. Jefferson was the strong advocate of the majority. Jefferson was, as I said, was the believer that the majority of the people can be trusted to govern themselves. The Federalists do not. That's why you've got Washington today making decisions that do not represent the majority of the people in this country. Did you ever wonder how they can do that? Their idea is, well, we're concerned for the nation and the majority just doesn't know what's going on. Well, that's totally against what Jefferson believed. That's called a Federalist position. And it was the Federalists that introduced these acts right here. Don't trust the majority. Don't ever let the majority be out there where they can take your power away. And so the Alien Enemies Act granted the president, during the time of war, the right to banish all aliens from American soil. And then came the Sedition Act. The Sedition Act stated that anyone who incited a riot or anyone who hampered the enforcement of a law was guilty of a crime. Now that's good. Nothing wrong with that. But right along with that was the statement that anybody who published or made false, scandalous, or malicious statements about the president or the Congress could be arrested. That's in America. And that law was passed. And it was called the Sedition Act. Basically, as a matter of fact, the only people ever arrested were Republicans. Republican publishers and Republican statesmen. were arrested under the Sedition Act. And that's what it was aimed at. It was aimed at eliminating your opposition. Now, you got to be careful because there's two political philosophies and ideologies, and one of them is what we would call a European ideology, which is if they don't agree with us, get rid of them. Kill them. It's the same. You're still dealing today with two philosophies. Haven't changed any. And while they were religious philosophies 2 centuries ago, now basically they've become political philosophies. And the philosophy of that crowd is if you don't agree with us, we've got to put legislation in power to stop you and to keep you from doing anything. We want the fairness doctrine. Amen. What is the fairness doctrine? The fairness doctrine is an effort to limit opposition sentiment on the radio. That's all it is. And you say, well, you know, I mean, didn't you ever wonder why that the liberal can't do what the conservatives have done? And I'm not an advocate of Rush Limbaugh, don't get me wrong. But isn't it amazing that the conservative Rush Limbaugh can gain the support he's gained in America, and they say, well, it's not fair. Wait a minute, I can name 8 or 9 liberals that have tried it and fallen flat on their face. You say, well, he's got the backing. Don't give me that. You look at the backing the liberals have got. You know, let me name a good liberal institution for you? Public radio. I mean, where's fairness? You listen to public radio and 99% of the, 99% of the statements you hear on public radio are going to be slanted toward the left. You don't believe that? Take a count. Find out. So, but the ideology is if you don't agree with us, we have to get rid of you. We want to stop you. We want to hold you in check because your philosophy is dangerous to us. Why? Because it can get the backing of the public. They're afraid of the majority. While they admit they don't agree with the majority making decisions, they're afraid of the majority. Y'all don't worry about them. They're going to teach Sunday school. Listen to me. Those acts are passed. I'll tell you what happens as a result of that. Jefferson goes to Kentucky. And Madison goes to Virginia, and they address the state houses in each state. And both states issue proclamations to the federal government that say this, you don't have the power to do that. They said the Constitution of the United States is an agreement between sovereign states, and those sovereign states will decide whether you violate that treaty or not, and we find you guilty of violating that treaty. What is that? That's states' rights. States checking the federal government. You don't have that anymore. As a result of 1865, it's no longer legal. But it did take place. Let me go one step further and then we'll get you into 1800. The election of 1800, Jefferson and Burr ran against Adams and Pinckney again. Now you think we get it right because the last time we had a mess with Vice President. So this time the presidential campaigns are waged, and lo and behold, guess what happens? I'll tell you what happens. Jefferson and Burr are the winners. They get the votes. Adams and Pinckney do not get enough votes. They're both ruled out. However, one problem occurs. Jefferson and Burr each got 73 electoral votes. Which means they tied. Now you got another problem. Who's the president? It took 36 ballots before Jefferson was elected president. Wouldn't it be great to waltz into the White House and know you just beat your vice president? I mean, what a level of popularity. On the 36th ballot. Suffice it to say, after this, what happened is the American people, the government, realized this electoral system isn't working. And so the 12th Amendment to the Constitution was ratified just prior to the next election in 1804, and it stated that the electors were not just given 2 votes. The electors were given 1 vote for president and 1 vote for vice president. And that basically is the system you live under today, which corrected itself. You see, before that, they cast their votes any way they wanted to. And some of those fellows would go and take both votes and cast them for the vice presidential candidate, which ended in a tie and a deadlock and 36 ballots before we get a president of the United States. And that now brings you up to 1800, all right? America is learning as it goes. We've experienced some problems, especially with our electoral system. We've experienced some problems in foreign policy. We've experienced some problems in domestic policy. But America is growing, and it is growing with a religious ideology. And we'll look at the change that occurs in about a century.